Welcome to Film Strips, the cold, clinical, emotionless film analysis podcast. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I am Andrew Kanagieser. And it's great to be here.
Absolutely. Welcome to the show. We are the podcast which every episode takes a look at a film, but somehow the film under discussion has to connect back to the film from the preceding week. So, Andrew, what was the film we were taking a look last time on this show?
Well, last time on this show, we were looking at and ended up compromising in the middle a lot more than I expected. We looked at Star Trek, The Motion Picture. And thankfully, dear listeners, we're not about to hit you with a classic 60s Shatner film when he was, quote-unquote, acting. Instead, we have followed everybody's favorite font of emotion, Leonard Nimoy, into Philip Coffin's 1978 adaptation of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, starring Donald Sutherland, Jeff Goldblum, the aforementioned Leonard Nimoy, Veronica Cartwright for bonus points, and Brooke Adams.
Yes, there we go. So yeah, and as you may notice from at least a few of those names, a few people we've dealt with before are popping up in this episode. Veronica Cartwright from Candyman 2, Farewell to the Flesh. Donald Sutherland was in The Split. And, well, I mean, obviously, we've already discussed where we were last seen Leonard Nimoy, so. Andrew, to get things started off here, I guess my first question is, why this film, and what maybe are we going to be taking a look at as we get into this one?
Well, I mean, this week it was my pick, and, I mean, I'll put it out there first that a big part of the rationale was that I didn't want to spend the next 6 weeks looking at different attempts for the Enterprise to save whales. But this was also a film that I hadn't seen for a number of years. I think the last time I watched this film was shortly before I went off to university and, not to say learned how to actually appreciate film, but was given a different vocabulary for it. And I think it just sort of naturally slides in with some of the larger themes that we've looked at in episodes past, because on the one hand, we have a very socially focused sci-fi slash horror narrative. We have an adaptation, and we also have one of those sort of franchise ideas that's so ubiquitous in the cultural imaginary that I feel like a lot of people skate by without ever having to sit down and watch the films themselves. And also we have Donald Sutherland in the 70s, who for my money is one of the coolest men on the planet.
Well, he's definitely one of the most interesting leading men on the planet. I'll give you that much for sure. But yeah, so okay. So plenty of there worth taking a look at this here. And of course, before we can even get into this film proper, I think one of the things we need to sort of address right off the bat is what you're sort of hinting at, which is the fact that Body Snatchers has entered into the popular imagination fairly thoroughly, but the roots for that actually begin decades before we arrive at this film, certainly starting with the Jack Finney novel, which was apparently originally published in, is it Collier Magazine, serialized if I'm not mistaken, and shortly thereafter it was adapted into the 1956 film Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Don Siegel. And I'm going to take it, Andrew, that you've seen the Siegel film prior to this.
Yes, I've seen the Siegel film. And yeah. I mean, they're, like, we've talked about sort of quick adaptations before, like how Father Goose, you know, that didn't even get published before it was turned into a movie. Finney's book, I believe, like when it's published as a standalone novel, that's in 1955, I believe. And Siegel's film adaptation comes out 1 year later. So It's clearly a text that has a lot of interest behind it. Now, the question I think that sort of naturally comes up when looking back at it is how much of that interest is the work itself versus how much of that interest is in how people read this text?
Well, it's interesting because the film comes out during what is one of our favorite topics here on this show, the Cold War. And at the time, a great deal of people read the film as either being about, you know, the threat of communism invading America. And, you know, it could be your neighbor or your neighbor.
Or all of our neighbors.
Indeed. Or some looked at it as a film about the communist witch hunts themselves, where maybe it's somebody coming after you. But of course, all that's kind of interesting because apparently Don Siegel never thought of the film in those terms. His actual consideration was consumerism and the sort of American, the flattening of America through the suburbs.
Yeah, and apparently Finney himself has said that, like, he never intended for his novel to have any kind of political overtones. But, I mean, when you're telling a story about conformity gone mad and sort of the detouring of a small town America, and it's coming out in the 1950s in the midst of the communism scare, it's pretty much impossible for people not to read it in those terms. And I mean, to be clear, like, for all we talk about the Red Scare, that kind of elides the fact that, no, I mean, there were a large number of Americans, like more than people might assume, that did identify as communists, that did become members of the actual American Communist Party, and did end up like acting seditiously within the official channels of American state power. But I mean, that's sort of the enduring legacy of Siegel's Body Snatchers is this sort of unresolvable debate. Is this a film that's warning us of the Red Menace, or is this a film that's so deliberately hyperbolistic in its representation that it's a satire of people that are terrified of the Red Menace?
And yeah, there's certainly a debate we're not going to settle on this episode, because mainly it's not the film we're covering. But I mean, certainly I think a couple points are worth noting as well about the movie beyond its political subject matter, which is certainly the way in which the film ended, I think is a good way. And note here, folks, we're not only going to be spoiling the heck out of the 78 film like we usually do, it's kind of important that we spoil the heck out of the 56 movie as well for our purposes here.
Don't forget the novel.
And the novel. Well, yeah, and the novel as well. Although, from the sounds of it, I haven't actually read Finney's book. So I should note that up front. It's probably the only version of the story that I haven't encountered yet. But by all accounts, apparently it ended on a fairly cheerful and somewhat anticlimactic note, with basically the pod people realizing, hey, we can't really hang out on Earth, we can't get the, you know, a handle on the situation, bye.
And then, well, I guess by that same token, before we can spoil the ending, we might actually want to lay out the broad strokes of it, because this is a story that has been adapted 4 different times directly. And I mean, there are certainly films that have been influenced by the narrative. The 101 version is that, because reasons, some kind of alien life form ends up on Earth, and one of the ways that it survives is it basically replicates objects around it. And in the 2 versions that we're talking about most directly, basically, yes, it's sort of like an alien plant life, a la Day of the Triffids, that eventually develops these pods that assume the shape and form and voice and mannerisms of that which they land next to. And eventually what that leads to is you have all these duplicates walking around in the place of everyone you knew and loved. They look exactly like the people you know, but there's something just a little off. And generally that's framed in terms of like a flattened affect. You know, that it looks like your grandpa, but instead of giving you a quarter for ice cream, he just stares at you blankly and then takes the garbage out.
Yeah, so, yeah, in effect, a little bit more emotionless is typically the way in which it's framed. Like, they lack human emotion. And in the case of the 56 film, there were supposed to, I mean, the book had a cheerful ending. The 56 film was supposed to end on a relatively bleak note, where it becomes clear that our main hero can't do anything to save the day. Everything's doomed in this instance. And that wasn't going to fly, apparently, in 1956. And pretty much Siegel was forced to throw on an ending that indicated that, yes, you know, everything isn't quite wrapped up neatly, but, you know, we're going to battle them here and, you know, take the fight to them and see if we can win the day.
Well, yeah, it's a case where the sort of studio-mandated coda, where after the iconic sequence of Kevin McCarthy and sort of the spinning camera, him in traffic screaming about how they're coming and then directly addressing the camera, then we suddenly have this odd frame narrative where all of a sudden a bunch of soldiers are like, hey, we found these pods falling out of a truck. Let's get them, men. And I also know that it's an ending that's so pat, some people read it in a very Hitchcockian way where it's so patently artificial that it's meant to be tongue in cheek. But I think it's a testament to the effectiveness of that penultimate sequence that's also echoed in the 1978 film. It's kind of amazing how many people think that McCarthy yelling at the camera actually is how the film ends. Like, that's the impactful part.
Well, it's interesting. I should note here, a few episodes ago, we noted the passing of Dr. Paul Hare, and he actually screened the 56 film in his science fiction film course back when I was at university, and he deliberately cut the film off after what was supposed to be the intended ending because he so vehemently hated everything that came afterwards.
Well, I see why everyone respected him so.
So, I absolutely agree. I mean, it's one of those things where I think a lot of you're quite right. Most people, they remember that ending. And funny enough, that ending does appear in the 78 film, not at the end of the film, but in a recontextualized version of In the Body of This. And we'll get to that in a bit, but it is interesting to say the least. So, that covers what we need to know about the 56 film. And popular culture goes on, and you're quite right, Andrew. Certainly through television broadcasts and any number of science fiction programs borrowing, if not the, elements or outright stealing elements for their stories, I'm fairly certain most people will have encountered this in some way, shape, or form. Even things such as, Doctor Who has done their own sort of body swap type, or
Of course, Doctor Who has.
yes, of course, the Zygons, by God. But yes, I digress.
I'll
So,
just smile and nod.
yeah,
But I
yes.
mean, I think part of why between 1956 and 2007, anyway, that we see four different tellings of this story is that we've talked at length in the past about like the cultural and historical specificity of horror. And that's not to say that Body Snatchers aims to be a capital H horror film first and foremost. It is rooted in sci-fi, but I think the horror elements definitely come more to the fore in the 1978 film, but it's also a narrative that I think is fairly adaptable to any period of cultural change and cultural confusion. But that sort of begs the question of when this film comes out in 1956, people have all these different readings that they apply to it, and no one seems to be able to agree. By the time 22 years later, you want to make this movie again, as Philip Kaufman did, that raises a couple interesting questions off the bat. Because A, you're now taking a film that is very closely linked discursively to McCarthyism and the Red Scare, which I mean, McCarthyism in strict terms was not a very long period of time. And also, like, the threat of communism, very different in 1978, perhaps a little less immediate. So the question is, like, are you speaking to those same concerns or are you applying them to something else? But also, by the time you remake this film in 1978, everybody's bringing the baggage and that desire to place that broader reading, as they did with the first one, onto this film. Like, that's necessarily going to happen regardless of Kaufman's political intent. And then the third question, and perhaps the most productive one to ask, is that when we say remake as opposed to an adaptation, I think that conjures a very specific idea that a film is going to be a certain, probably like more than 50% faithful to the source text that it's repurposing. And I guess maybe to lead us off in our discussion of the 1978 one, would you say that Body Snatcher 78 is a remake?
It's an interesting question, and again, I guess it comes right back down to how we choose to define a remake versus secondary adaptation. Again, certain former profs of mine would probably be pointing, like, no, it's not a remake, it's another adaptation, which ostensibly it is. It's adapting Jack Finney's book, but it's doing so with the awareness of the original of the first adaptation in its mind, and this film goes out of its way to deliberately reference and evoke that original film in this one, so you can't really discount it. And to me, it's one of these things where you risk splitting apples and oranges. I mean, ostensibly, at the end of the day, whether you call it a remake or not, it's a film that is certainly playing with the fact that to some degree, the audience already is aware of what's preceded it and what those expectations are. Because certainly, I think the broad strokes of the story, like the absolute framework of it, is certainly there. But once you start getting into the minutiae and the details of this film and the characters, it's a very different movie.
Yeah, it's a curious companion piece where thematically there are some very clear links between the two. And there, as you said, there are a number of moments where it's deliberately evoking like specific moments and specific ideas from the original. Whereas at the same time, it expands upon those ideas and sort of takes more time to breathe and play around with them. And I think sort of by the time this film opens, before the credits even roll, like, we already can detect one pretty significant change, because Body Snatchers, the novel, and the Siegel film, is it San Clara or something? A fictional California town. It's presented as small town USA. Everybody knows their neighbor, and sort of the creeping sedition of the aliens is destabilizing polite Leave It to Beaver society. Whereas we open the 1978 one, the first scene of an urban landscape, it's San Francisco in 1978, and that is decidedly not small town USA.
No, it's not. I mean, this is certainly the city which, on one hand, is probably considered one of the centers of the more liberal America, I guess is the way to frame it for our context. And certainly is one of the, it's an urban area. It is a world that is, in some aspects, would we consider cosmopolitan. And it's also interesting, you're right, it's a very significant shift to make right off the bat, Right off the bat. Thank you, folks. I'm not recording this late on a Friday night.
But if you're not, then who is? But yeah, like, because I think the reason why the 1956 version holds up is because that idea of, like, the everyday and the familiar somehow gets twisted. And sort of the typical trappings and iconography of comfort and closeness and community, those all end up getting displaced, if not altogether destroyed. Whereas by setting it in San Francisco, a city full of, as most people would probably think, like, freaks and weirdos and eccentrics and, like, the remnants of the Haight-Ashbury years, all of a sudden, you already know it's going in a different direction. The same way that, almost like Coppola's The Conversation. That's very much a film about the sort of necessary insanity that comes with living in urbanized settings. And sort of the idea that the city itself, as its own organism in a way that produces craziness amongst those who live there. Like, this is a film that's not about the fraying of community. This is a film where it's like there's an absence of community from the hop.
Well, you're right. I think part of what's going on with this film is this comes out in 1978. So it's not quite, we're not at Reagan America yet. But the thing about it is, you know, this is the point where America is definitely sort of crystallizing into what would become known as the me generation, the sort of self-interested, self-obsessed decade with the celebration of greed and that. And I think it's very telling when you're looking at this film that in many cases, you're right, we are dealing with figures who, it's not just that, you know, they are would be considered fringe players in other areas, but it's the fact that everybody to some degree is either disconnected from who they're surrounded by, even the people that in their immediate vicinity, and everybody has their own self-interest, which is overtaking everything else in the course of them. And certainly we get more, right off the bat, the film opens up, or the first character we're introduced to is Elizabeth Driscoll, who's living with her boyfriend, Jeffrey, played by Art Hindle. And what is their relationship like? We see scenes where they're framed at a distance in their homes, and we're not really getting clear looks at him or her, but we can see he has these, headphones on so he can watch the game while she's describing what went on in her day and this interesting plant she found and other things. And there's this clear sense that neither one is really communicating with one another or that, you know, has much really invested or is really cares for the other one necessarily.
There's a certain remove in the relationship. And I think the way that this scene is shot, like, the camera is positioned in a way that is sort of looking through a doorway, and we're only seeing the figures when they either pass through the doorway or their reflection on a pane of glass. So there's this sort of doubled refraction there.
Exactly. And as the film goes on, we kind of see this repeat time and again in different variations. Certainly, I think one of the most telling ones is Jack, played by Jeff Goldblum in this film. A poet who, you know, despite the fact that, you know, by the point he's introduced, Matthew, played by Donald Sutherland, and Elizabeth have seen somebody run over, they're calling in trying to phone this in. And all Jack can do throughout the entire time is rant and rave about how ridiculous it is that everybody's paying attention to Kibner, the psychiatrist played by Leonard Nimoy in this film. And he's ranting and raving and not listening to them and sort of not interested in the fact that, oh yeah, a man's dead. They're trying to call in a thing. He isn't even paying attention. He's just going on and on and on.
Yeah, can you believe this? People don't appreciate me? Put that phone down.
Well, exactly. And this seems to be, in, you know, even like little subtle things. When Kibner finally sees Matthew at the same said scene, his initial instinct is, hey, why did you close down, get the restaurant that I love going to closed down? Now there's nowhere for me to eat in the city. It's a fascinating thing because what we haven't mentioned yet is that Matthew and Elizabeth work for the Department of Health in San Francisco, and they're little mid-level bureaucrats whose jobs it is to take a look, you know, at, you know, restaurants and make sure that they're living up to code. And Matthew has shut down that restaurant for legitimate reasons, as we see in the film. So it's interesting. I mean, it's very curious to see how that sort of plays out. And certainly the idea of then how this expands into things such as new age psychology and, you know, how, you know, we can help one another. And, you know, what is the proper way to be a better person in our contemporary society? It all sort of strings together quite neatly and nicely throughout this film.
Well, yeah. And, like, it's sort of, Matthew is undoubtedly the central character in this film. He is our protagonist. He is our through line. But even with him, from his introduction, there is something just a little strange about him. Because as you brought up before we started recording, he is introduced not through like an establishing shot or the classic John Wayne rack zoom that, you know, firmly signposts this is our hero. Instead, we see from the interior of a restaurant, we hear a knock at the door, and then we look through the spyglass. And through this weird fish-eyed distortion, we see Matthew banging on the door and has a Department of Health. And I personally love the little affectation that, yes, our main character is a health inspector. Yeah. I can't think of any other movie where that is any character's profession. I kind of love it. But that leads to the scene where he goes into this beautiful and, like, ornately decorated French restaurant. And he's going through the kitchen, like, examining everything, which leads to an amusing argument over whether something in a dish is a caper or rat feces. but, I mean, even, like, in that scene, though, how he's demanding that the cooks tell him what's supposed to be in the dish, and the maitre d' says, well, we can't tell you, it's a secret recipe. And then he has that very ominous line where he just looks at them in that classic Sutherland way, and he says, you don't have any secrets from the Department of Health. And it's like, so our main character, he's a health inspector, but he's also a crypto-fascist? Like, it's very destabilizing, and it's odd because he's very, very sullen and very sort of downcast and straight-laced. But then immediately after, when we see him in the office at City Hall with Elizabeth, we see that warm smile and sort of like that smart-ass sense of humor. And when Elizabeth is talking about how her husband seems a little bit off, and that's also weird because, you know, it's not until Elizabeth mentions that the man in the scene with her is her husband that I'm like, oh, because I did not pick up on that from the way that they're framed in that initial conversation. But yeah, you see like a warmth come out of Matthew, but even then it seems odd because it's like, well, this guy clearly has the hots for a married woman. So it seems we end up empathizing with our characters and liking them, but from frame one, this film goes out of its way to indicate that even with the hero, something's a little bit off.
Well, they're all very messy and weird, and I think, again, part and parcel of this, I mean, one of my ways of describing Sutherland in this film is the cross between a noir detective and a hippie, and if you can put that together, you kind of have an indication as to how he sort of, the visual figure he cuts in this film. But you're right, I think part and parcel of that, again, to come back to another one of our favorite subjects, post-JFK, post-MLK, post-Robert Kennedy assassination America, and post-Watergate America, this is, the authority figures aren't quite the trustworthy figures we typically had seen in films like, again, the 1950s, 40s, and 50s cycle G-Men films, for example. I mean, ostensibly, Matthew is an authority figure. He is a representative of the city and its authority. And yet, he doesn't. Nothing really about him really gels as an authority figure in the traditional sense. He just, like, there's something about him that looks like he should be the, he's just one step removed from hanging out with the beatniks, and getting stoned in another room off somewhere. And that's, again, in 1978, that's kind of an interesting figure to put there. But I think that also ends up speaking to, as the film goes on, kind of the problem as to why this film's going to end the way it does for our characters.
Well, yeah, because I mean, yeah. So the first indicator that something beyond our comprehension is happening is that one night the glass of water at the bedside table ends up falling over and smashing where the strange flower that Elizabeth had found kept it there. And the next morning she notices that, well, her husband is there, but he's acting very odd, just staring at her, not talking, and bringing something out to the garbage truck. And from there, she begins developing the sense that the man who's her husband is no longer her husband. Now, there's a very real psychological condition called the Capgras delusion, where this is a documented phenomenon where people are genuinely convinced that someone they love has been replaced by a double. But I think, especially in the context of 1978 and sort of with the burgeoning pop psychology movement, sort of the widespread acceptance of people having an analyst, not solely because of Woody Allen films, there's a greater awareness of, I think, psychological and psychiatric concepts in popular consciousness. And I think this film is very smart in how it plays off the fact that no, there's a rational explanation for everything. It can't be something as preposterous as interstellar life forms assuming the form of our vegetation and then adapting to new hosts.
Well, it's interesting because the thing about this film that I think is fascinating is when we get down to it, when you look at the original film, the first adaptation, it's mainly about Matthew Equivalent in that film, trying to get people to believe him and go on and recognize the threat that's there. There's a brilliant aspect to this film where there seems to be the question of just how far the rap down the rabbit hole people can be or are willing to go in America at this point, because once everybody sort of starts adapting or to the notion that yes, there is an alien threat here that is going after us, what we start to see about Matthew and his, little band of heroes, for lack of a better explanation, is it's made up of people like Nancy. And as we come to discover about Nancy, she will believe the most, almost anything, including the fact that aliens had, messed with human evolution thousands of years ago. And the thing about it is the way in which that scene where she makes those statements plays out, it's the kind of the recognition of the fact of the matter is, well, once you accept the crazy thing that's happening now, how much crazier can are any of these things really down the line? Because there's that sort of recognition of like, yeah, that's pretty wild of her to say, but at what point do you start saying, well, no, that's just out of the ordinary? You're already in a situation that is out of the
Well,
ordinary.
exactly. It's like the one interesting thing. Well, there's more than one, but one thing I've always found very interesting about conspiracy theory discourse is that it's a system that can always resolve any contradiction. The same way that it's, oh, well, if 9/11 was an inside job and, the US government killed 2,800 people for reasons, then why would they allow movies like Zeitgeist to be released that blow open the whole story? And sometimes you'll meet truthers who are like, well, no, see, that's the thing. They want to have stuff out there because that way it'll show the people telling those stories are crazy. It's a false flag and people won't believe it. There's always a rational explanation whether you're looking at it from the inside or the outside of the theory. And like, this is a film that does not shy away from using very pointed language about conspiracies. And especially about the idea of like this sort of urban insanity. Early on, as Elizabeth becomes more and more convinced that her husband is somebody else, she has that very telling line where she asks Matthew, "Do you believe that if you think you're going crazy, it really means that you're not?" But at the same time, like all the characters soon realize, the more and more convinced that they are sane, the more and more unhinged they all start acting. And it's the party sequence, I think, is pretty key because that's sort of when Matthew begins to believe. Because he's initially driving over to introduce Elizabeth to his friend, Dr. Kibner, who is, this famous psychologist who, as Jack derisively points out, just puts out a book every 6 months with the same ideas and a different cover. But en route there, all of a sudden, their vehicle is stopped by Kevin McCarthy himself. Well,
Yes.
playing a role here, but he basically runs up to the car and gives that same monologue that he does at the end of Siegel's 1956 film. And all of a sudden, though, he runs off screen and then is he struck by a car or is his death ever really explained? We just see him lying on the ground with blood from his ears.
The way in which it's staged is we hear a noise which presumably sounds like a car may have struck him. We don't really see. All we know is that the way in which it's staged, we're seeing basically overhead shots from behind Matthew and Elizabeth as they're in a car. And as they turn the corner, you see a crowd of people and an officer there with McCarthy's body laid out on the ground. Blood dripping from his ear. But the thing that, again, that's mildly creepy about it is that nobody's behaving like you would typically expect when somebody's just been struck. They're all very orderly. They're all just sort of standing there. Nobody's taking off or taking photos or reacting in any reasonable way. It's just very, very eerie the way in which it's handled.
Well, yeah. And it's creepier still when Matthew gets to the party and he tries to call in the accident. And then he's basically told by the dispatcher that no, there's no dead body on that corner. Nothing happened. And that is when they start using the word conspiracy. And for a post-everything American film, I mean, it's very difficult after 1963 to use the word conspiracy in a film without that conjuring some pretty specific ideas.
Well, absolutely. And it's very fascinating how the film plays out because this party scene, as we get into it, ends up, introducing, as we've sort of acknowledged, the characters of Jack and Kibner into the film at this point. And again, we'll get into Jack in a minute, but we really need to get into Leonard Nimoy and Kibner at this point because he becomes kind of the crux, more or less, in this instance. Because the reason they've gone to see him is that Matthew thinks, by talking to Kibner, Elizabeth can get a better sense as to what's actually going on in her life and that everything will be okay. And Kibner, as they're sort of leaving the party and walking down the street and is talking to her, is coming up with these rather rational explanations for what might be going on, and that in another movie you would probably sit there and accept that, okay, maybe this is the case, and maybe they would play with the tension of is this what's really going or not?
Yeah, he's the doctor at the end of Psycho, only he shows up a third of the way into this movie.
And the way, and what's interesting here is this leads to an interesting scene where, well, let's start with the casting of Nimoy itself, because it's so, this is weaponized casting at its finest that I've ever seen in a film, because Kaufman cast Nimoy knowing full damn well what people are bringing to the table when he comes into this movie. Because, yeah, Nimoy at this point was famous for playing Mr. Spock, the voice of authority on the Enterprise, the purely logical one, and the dude who's always in control of his emotions and doesn't let you see them.
And generally tends to be right about everything, too.
Exactly. And when he's introduced here, I think what's interesting is that there is a slight bit more emotion from Nimoy here compared to what he does as Mr. Spock. Like, it's a little more overt. And there's just enough touches. Like, the way in which this scene ends, it's with Matthew and Kibner just sort of talking outside the car that Elizabeth's sitting in there and discussing about the situation and what they think. And there's a nice back and forth where you really get the sense that, yeah, these guys are friends. And Kibner, as much as we might want to write him off as a pop psychologist, it's not because he lacks for care, necessarily.
Well, it's not so much that he's an emotive figure as much as he's a paternal character,
yeah.
I think, as opposed to his most famous on-screen role of Mr. Spock.
Yes, but what ends up being interesting is, as the film goes on, is that because of what we've associated with Nimoy, it's really hard to get a bead on when does Kibner actually transition over into being a pod person.
Now, see, I had that same question myself, because I don't know when it happens. Spoiler alert, turns out that Kibner does get consumed by the pod people. But yeah, because they're throughout most of the film, like, Kibner initially tries to talk everybody out of it. And he, you know, there is that scene where he basically, like, you know, grabs the bridge of his nose and lets out the sigh. And he's like, okay, so you're all sitting here telling me that something came from outer space and is copying the people you love. Think about what that sounds like. It's like, there's no way that this can be happening. But then shortly after that sequence, though, he leaves the house and he gets into a car. And then we see Elizabeth's husband and some other of the unnamed conspirators. And he basically just says, we have to move quickly. And that, I think it does raise the interesting question of, is Kibner from the get-go, like, because it's Leonard Nimoy and because there is that stiltedness to him, it's like, I think it's impossible to determine when he stops being himself. But I think this film does miss a trick, though, because I think there's a certain intellectual appeal in the idea of these aliens have come to Earth and they're consuming everybody, except what if Kibner was human all this time? And he was like their sort of Judas goat leading all the people to their doom under the guise of reassurance and Father Doe's best type psychology.
It would be an interesting idea. Thematically... I think it's an interesting idea. I don't know whether, in terms of plot logistics and that would necessarily hold up too well, because the question would then become, well, why do they need him? Because when you think through the entirety of the thing, I mean, the first that we never even did describe the opening sequence of this movie, which is basically what we get is almost like this microscopic imagery of, you know, either spores or something out in space. It's very alien, very weird.
Incredibly phallic, too.
Yeah. And when all of a sudden it comes to Earth, and what we recognize is that what we're led to believe, you know, we come into a rainy San Francisco day, and it becomes very clear that whatever these pod things are, they're not arriving, like, in giant pods and landing on Earth. They're entering our atmosphere, blending in with the water, the rainwater, and they're landing on our plants. They're landing in our rivers. They're landing all over.
Well, what's that line that Nancy says? It's, why did we always assume that they were going to come in silver ships?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about it is because they're, I mean, to answer, come back to your question about, you know, Kibner being, you know, the Judas of this potentially here. The thing about it is because they're already all over. There's not really a need for Kibner necessarily for that purpose. But again, I like that. I do think that's an interesting concept. I could see that definitely being played with in another remake of doing something.
Because given what the film does on screen in terms of its presentation of authority and sort of structures of power and sort of the idea of corruption at an institutional level, I think there is a certain compatibility with the notion that, well, it's not that America went sour because, like, I feel like it's almost a cop out to be like, well, it's because everyone got taken over by aliens. I think it's a far scarier implication to be like, but sometimes just by being ourselves, humans are capable of great evil deeds.
Well, and I think this does speak to what's kind of interesting about this film, and not necessarily in the idea that just by being human we're capable of great evil deeds, although that's certainly the case. I would say in the case of this film, what's interesting is that, you know, our heroes are doomed from the outset because of the thing that they're about to lose, which is their humanity. And what does this film postulate that humanity is? It's big, it's messy, it's self-interested, it kind of crazy. And ultimately, yeah, all the things that make you human may mean that make it impossible for us to organize in any meaningful sense to counter this threat. Because what happens to our heroes? Well, Matthew is ostensibly the authority, an authority figure in this film, and he, as much as he's fringy, sort of in some ways appeals to the fringe and hangs out with people even further to the fringe, he kind of believes in the system. He tries going through the system. I'm going to make all the proper calls. I'm going to make, you know, try and contact all the necessary people. And you get that great sequence of Donald Sutherland basically hanging out in a phone booth and walking the streets of San Francisco over this audio montage of him making desperate phone calls, trying to get anybody to listen.
And meanwhile, getting all those quick cuts of just being in a wide open, crowded urban space and everybody is looking at you. And there's something deeply unsettling about that as well.
Absolutely. And then you get later scenes where even once, you know, everything's fallen into place and there's that phone call where they mention him by name, even though he hasn't given his name, he still can't rationalize that or understand, and he's asking questions. And Jack, the character who, you know, probably for once in the entire film gives decent advice, it's like, just hang up the phone, accept it. But of course, what are our other options? We got Jack, a self-interested poet that, what does he bring to the table? What can he offer as part of the resistance? You've got Nancy, who,
Well, he can offer a bathhouse.
well, okay, there is that. You've got Nancy, his wife, who, you know, again, as we already acknowledged, she's the best survivalist of the group. We will say that ultimately, but it's basically because she's willing to go so far down the rabbit hole and just go with the flow of things. That's not really good for organizing or preparing for anything. And, you know, you got Elizabeth, who, as the film goes on, both her health and her mental state deteriorate at fairly rapid progress. So yeah, our heroes are basically screwed from frame one. And what can anybody do in these situations? Because, you know, humanity has proven time and again, you know, we are terrible at gathering around, coalescing and, you know, getting stuff done. I mean, I think it doesn't take much to look at the culture of 2018 and the sheer amount of infighting about anything and everything, to kind of, you know, point out, it's like, well,
Yeah. I like Shira the old-fashioned way.
But it's just the thing where it's, you know, I mean, yeah, we are terrible at countering situations of immense threat because we can't get ourselves organized at all. We will have debates and fights and anything else. And I think there is something very charming as well about the notion that Matthew, a city employee, would need a celebrity to help him get the ear of the mayor, necessarily. That
Yeah.
is, yeah,
Well,
sorry.
I mean, there is something like just very humorous in concept of saying, Mr. Mayor, you have to listen to us. I'm a health inspector and he's a famous doctor, and we need to tell you about what's really going on. But I mean, like, it speaks to sort of the craziness of urban sites like San Francisco anyway. And as you brought up with Kevin McCarthy's brief scene early on in the film, how it's not entirely clear like how widespread this invasion is. And like once it happens, it hits that critical mass pretty quickly. But the whole idea of that crowd just with no affect, like just sort of circling around him and observing, That's not dissimilar from earlier in the film when Matthew's walking through through the streets, and he sees the sort of the local vagrant playing his banjo with his dog, and they just share that little nod. Or probably most bizarrely, like after the shots of the raindrops falling on the plants, we get that very peculiar
Yes.
image of Elizabeth walking, and then she passes a woman. The camera pans and follows the woman. She goes around the corner to a playground. And what's there on the playground, David?
Robert Duvall is a Catholic priest swinging alongside a child whose point of view we then cut to for, again, not clear narrative reasons.
But I think for thematic
Yeah.
reasons, though, it shows that, like, urban space, as you pointed out, it is eccentric, and human lives are messy and weird. And sort of in order to navigate that and make sense of it and make like sort of like this sensory overload even manageable, like we basically have to filter out a lot of our sort of affectative responses to things. Like, I live in London, Ontario, and it's not a cosmopolitan region. It's not even a big city compared to some in the world. But like, every now and then you'll see a guy like yelling at his sweater on a bus, and you just sort of look up and then look back down to your book and make sure that your headphones are in, and you just go with it. The same way that when Elizabeth starts talking about her husband's been replaced, everybody else just kind of nods and, oh yeah. And then they just go about their own thing. And it's that sort of forced insularity. I think that is also sort of what's being condemned here. That the same way that we're able to even survive living in urban areas is the exact same thing that allows this fictional invasion to go off as well as it does.
No, I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, it's certainly, I mean, in keeping with the sort of, I don't know, does this film sort of cross into nihilism, do you think, to a degree or not?
I think it
Yeah.
does, especially by the time we get to the
Yeah.
ending, because this is a film that has many moments where it gives you a sense of hope, only to almost immediately
Yeah.
snuff it out. Because, let's see, they discover a pod in the midst of forming at Jack and Nancy's bathhouse, and then they think, okay, now we have proof. Let's go get Dr. Kibner. By the time they come back, the body is gone. Elizabeth gets kidnapped by her husband and is in the process of being converted. And then Matthew shows up and rescues her in a very expressionistically shot sequence. And everything's okay until about 20 minutes later when she falls asleep and succumbs anyway. And I think probably the biggest moment of this is, as you mentioned, the Amazing Grace sequence.
Yeah, this is to make this clear, there's a point where late in the film, it's just down to Matthew and Elizabeth. They're on the run. They have absolutely no idea who to trust, and as they're in this sort of field near the shoreline of San Francisco, and the docks, Elizabeth and Matthew hear Amazing Grace off in the distance, and they realize, oh, it's a ship coming into shore. And yes, we can get on a ship, we can get out of here, everything will be fine. And Matthew, in the first of in the f one really terrible decision, decides, you stay here, I'm gonna go check it out. You as the the hopefulness of Amazing Grace is playing, he comes onto the scene, the music swells and swells, and then he realizes they're putting pods onto the ship, waiting to ship them out. And of course, as this happens, Amazing Grace, suddenly you start hearing white noise cutting in, like the radio's going distorted, and just sort of cops it. It becomes this really weird and eerie and utterly deflating scene. Matthew wanders back, and oh, lo and behold, Elizabeth is now be in the time he's been gone, fell asleep and has been replaced.
Well, yeah, because as we also discover, the whole reason that this transformation happens, it's not that you are turned into something else, it's that these alien plants assume your form. And it only happens when you're sleeping, and when they have finalized your form, you basically disappear into a bag of dust. It's an interesting visual
Yeah.
effect, but I think that Amazing Grace scene, though, I think that also really plays with the audience's awareness of the Siegel film. Because you hear the triumphant music and you see the ships coming in, and there's that brief moment where, even though I had seen the film before, I wanted to believe, just as Matthew does, that it's like, oh, well, just like how the soldiers bumped into that truck and realized, oh no, Earth is being attacked. It's like, oh, here comes the Navy to save the day. And then you suddenly see it up close, and then you realize, nope, that is not going to save you this time.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it is such a crushing moment. And what I think is, the film, this point forward, the film follows Matthew as he basically is chased in desperately running around, trying to do anything and everything to survive and not become one of them, which leads to the sort of climactic thing where he comes across basically a grow operation for the pods. At which he proceeds to burn to the ground with a fire axe and some placed lights. And, this ostensibly serves as the climax of the film, but of course, he's still being chased. He ends up under basically the walkways of a dock, trying to hide. And this leads to what I think is a great edit where you just hear the pod people up above just talking about it's like, well, he can't have run far. I mean, he's got to fall asleep sometime. And you just see a light flashing through the little hole where Matthew is. And it's not clear whether they see him or not. The light ends up acting as a wipe as we end up to the next day.
Yeah, it's a remarkably subtle shot in a part of the film where everything is full tilt bonkers. Because yeah, like I can see another director doing that sequence where he's about to look out, and then all of a sudden a head pops into the frame, and then there's the musical stinger. Or, that he'll cough or something, and then all of a sudden, like, the footsteps get louder and it zooms in on his face, and then we cut or something. Here, it's like the guy looks down and for once doesn't make that mechanical alien scream when he recognizes. He just scans around, and as the flashlight basically points to the camera, the wipe occurs. And again, like it's just that flatness of it, where it up until the moment that transition occurs, it's still sort of unclear. Like maybe he won't see him, and you want to hold on to that hope, even though you know it's probably a false hope. The same way that Matthew destroying this one warehouse, like it's his moment of triumph, I guess. But given the scale of the invasion that we've seen, to the point where they can be loading up cargo ships with pods, him burning down one warehouse is not going to make a single bit of difference. And we know that,
It's an empty symbolic victory. Like there's nothing of substance to what he does. It's just a fleeting moment of, trying to take control of the situation that you ultimately have still no control over at the end of the day. And from there that ends up, taking the film into its climax where we see Matthew and he's returning to work, Elizabeth's there, and nothing seems to really be happening other than, them all mechanically going through the motions of the day. And it's not clear whether Matthew is just trying to blend in.
Well, yeah, because the operative part that we forgot to mention is that there's a lot going on in this film, but Nancy comes to the realization earlier on that it is possible to blend in with the new humans. You basically just have to act completely without emotion. And I mean, it's basically like a proto Shaun of the Dead in that sense. But yeah, so at the end, we see Matthew walking around and he's flat, but he's also not being pursued. So there is that ambiguity, right?
And it leads to eventually a shot of Matthew walking the streets of San Francisco after work. Amazing Grace in a very sort of distorted form is once again playing on the soundtrack. But again, like I said, very distorted, very alien, very wonderful. And there's Nancy. And in a moment of, she just walks up to Matthew and starts talking to him as if, is everything okay? Did you make it? Is everything going? And we just cut to a shot of Donald Sutherland pointing at her, opening his mouth in that creepy way, and letting out that utterly alien scream. point out that, yep, no, she's been found out, and he is long gone at this point in time.
Yeah, and we just hold on Matthew's screaming face, and then Ultraman cuts to Nancy breaking down in tears. And apocryphally, that apparently was a completely organic reaction that I've heard that Philip Kaufman didn't actually tell Veronica Cartwright what was going to happen in that scene. So the fear on her face is supposed to be completely genuine.
I guess that's possible. Something tells me, I'm not sure whether I buy that, only because presumably she would have seen the script. Presumably, I don't think that this ending was just improvised on the day, necessarily. I would imagine there would have had to be some level of planning to arrive at that particular climax.
True, but oddly enough, for all we talked about the Siegel film being mandated to have a different ending, apparently Philip Kaufman from the get-go wanted to make a much bleaker film, and the studio wanted to have an ending that was more ambiguous. Apparently it was supposed to end with Matthew and Nancy sharing a look as they both shuffle off through the crowd, like hiding in plain sight, and it's sort of left to the viewer to decide whether one of them was still human, whether both of them were or not. So I guess the story would go that that was the ending they were supposed to shoot, and then Donald Sutherland and the camera crew surprised her that way. It's a nice story. I don't know if it's true. I don't even know if it's necessary, though, because instead we end up with one of the most iconic closing shots of any film. Certainly from the 1970s, and still today, a profoundly effective moment.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, it's hands down just a moment of bleakness that will, certainly you're not leaving this film comforted at the end of the day.
Yeah, like, this is the moment where the coffin lid shuts on you.
Yeah, so, and I mean, and it's such an affecting ending. It just, yeah, by the end of it, you are left to grapple with just what ultimately the film is. I don't want to say what it's really about, because, I mean, it's about any number of things. But, I mean, ultimately, what we're sort of to take away from this, whether, you know, there's any, I don't want to say life message or something ridiculous and reductive like that, but certainly,
or a pointed message, maybe.
Yeah, because in this instance, I mean, this film sort of kicks off what I would say is sort of the trinity of great late 70s, early to mid 1980s remakes, because you get this one.
Okay, I'll bite. What are the other two?
John Carpenter's The Thing, which, much like this film, takes the original movie, expands upon it, and goes much more nihilistic and bleak with it. And again, an amazing film which outdoes its original. And David Cronenberg's The Fly, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But I would say in the case of those two movies, their sort of commentary and points, I think, are very clear at the end of the day. I mean, Cronenberg's film, whether he denies it or not, I mean, I think it's certainly definitely about the sexual politics of the 1980s, particularly in the era of the rise of AIDS. I don't think, no matter how much he denies it, that can be taken out of the, or really be ignored. Likewise,
and I mean, it's David Cronenberg. Has he seen any other David Cronenberg film?
Yeah, precisely. But then, I mean, as far as Carpenter's film goes, I mean, that's sort of, you know, paranoia, and again, very similar to Body Snatchers in the sense that, are you you? Or would you even be aware if you're not you? And what do you do in those situations? I mean, it's basically Body Snatchers taken to a brutally nihilistic ending that does not. Not only is it not comforting, but I mean, it gives the senses to just, you know, how defeating, you know, sort of paranoia and survival instincts really become. I don't know whether this film has as pointed a sort of message that it's going after, necessarily.
Well, I think the only issue I would take with your reading of this film being sort of an indictment of, I guess, the proto-me generation, I guess, sort of baby boomer culture of the late 70s, is, like, that's sort of an easy target. And, I mean, like, even the year prior in Annie Hall, like, Woody Allen sort of sends that up pretty well in the scenes that take place in Hollywood. And oddly enough, Jeff Goldblum appears there as well. But I mean, like, if we're critiquing the idea of modern urban living as this sort of self-absorbed, feelings first sort of mode of living, and like we're constantly being shown images of like storefronts and neon signs and specifically garbage trucks and like the refuse of consumer culture. That's one thing, and you can point your finger and be like, well, this film is also critiquing how that makes us weak, that makes us insular. We fragment our ideas of community. And like through Kibner especially, like he explicitly talks about that message. When he's trying to reassure Elizabeth, he has that rant where he goes off on the problem is people don't realize that it takes work to be in relationships, and they just want to drop in when the going gets tough, and that breaks up families, that breaks up communities. But the problem is, especially given that we don't know when Kibner sort of makes that turn, it's not entirely clear whether or not we're supposed to agree with him or take his position to be the film's position. Because if that's the case, and we're critiquing the me generation, then what's that being replaced with? Flat, emotionless alien pathogens that are trying to stamp out everything we love. So it's like, okay, an overabundance of emotion and self-absorption makes you crazy, but a complete lack of it is just inhuman and not at all the fate that any of us want to have. And I think the difficulty for me is like, how do you place those two poles of the film in dialogue with one another?
Well, I think it would say that assumes that there is a positive option in either instance. I would say that this is a film that almost postulates that there is no better version. I mean, basically, you're screwed one way or the other. It's just a matter of what's the better alternative between the two, being a complete mess or being at least orderly enough to be able to survive and make your way through. And
Yeah, do you want to be punched in the face a dozen times, or do you want to have your hair lit on fire?
well, in essence, I mean, you're not wrong with that analogy. I think that really does speak to what the film is giving us. Because, yeah, when you get right down to it, everybody's life in this film, right from the get-go, is in some way kind of messed up. I mean, Jack's clearly not happy. Nancy, it's hard to get a bead on as to how happy she is or isn't, really, because.
Yeah, she's the least developed of the central cast, I would
Yeah, I
say.
mean, Elizabeth seems to be in a relationship that even from the get-go, before any pod replacements happen, we can already take suggestions that maybe it's not likely to last much longer. And yeah, Sutherland's Matthew is, like, always seems to be within an instant of just trying outright hitting on Elizabeth at any given moment. Throughout this, despite the fact that that's a probably in many, well, not just probably, that's a terrible idea for all sorts of reasons.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's Donald Sutherland in the 70s, so he's charming enough that we kind of forget it. But yeah, when you take a step back, be like, yeah, 90, 95% of the dialogue scenes is him acknowledging she's a married woman and flirting with her anyway.
Well, and that's exactly it. And I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I buy that, they probably have better chemistry and connection than her and Jeffrey do. But at the same time, A, we don't really know much about Jeffrey beyond what we see in those initial few scenes before he gets replaced. So.
He looks like a pouty Art Garfunkel. I mean, going to Donald Sutherland is definitely a trade up.
Well, he is also the star of David Cronenberg's The Brood, which one of these days we'll get to. No, that's not the next film.
Oh,
Yeah, that's
yeah!
not the film we're covering next, folks. I'll leave that nightmare FOMO
Oh.
for another time. Because man, oh man, is that film messed up. But.
Actually, I only have a DVD copy of that, thanks to David.
Well, and the only reason you have that DVD copy, thanks to me, is because thanks to Criterion for putting it out again, in a nice souped-up edition. Seriously, people, go get your hands on The Brood. It's awesome. And yeah, just make sure you have a few days to try and readjust your sleep schedule afterwards, because it will mess you up. But yes, that's either here nor there. But I think this is the thing with this movie is it's a really weird movie in many ways because yeah, it's not a film that reaffirms the positive qualities of humanity. It's not a film that really wants to comfort you in any way, shape, or form, and it's not offering you any easy outs.
Yeah, it doesn't postulate an escape from this scenario.
Exactly.
And I guess that's very difficult. It's not that there was never like sci-fi or horror films that ended on a down note prior to this, but there's something so bleak about how it happens here. And I guess the reason that I'm trying to think of this, and I know I've said before that not every film needs to have a message or a moral, and I know that, longtime listeners will know that we spent most of our episode on Michael Mann's Heat just screaming back and forth about the idea of this film having a message. But I guess in the context of this film, especially as a reworking of the Siegel film, people approach that as like a sociopolitical commentary kind of by accident. Whereas here, they're making this film with the knowledge that that's what people expect. And this film also is making direct commentary on the modern condition. Like through its dialogue, through its setting, through its location, the problem emerges when you realize, okay, well, it's making all of these gestures, but it's not totally clear what it's gesturing toward, other than, well, here's all the different reasons why your puny planet is doomed.
And in a way, that's fairly brave filmmaking because, I mean, there is that temptation. I could easily see to want to clear it up, to make it somewhat more palatable. And this film, it's not interested in being palatable. And that's not just
Yeah, and that is by no means a criticism, mind
Exactly.
you.
And it's not intended as a pun, given the amount of food consumption that goes on in this film as well. But yeah, I'll just leave that in the air, folks, for you can to laugh about there for a few moments.
Honestly, I've spent the last hour regretting the fact that we didn't open this episode with a joke about podcasting.
Boo. See, this is why I look down on puns, people. Why I look down on puns. But I digress. At any rate, but no, I would agree with you. I think it probably helps, though, to look at this film in large part as part of an overall cycle of, what's going on in American cinema at this point, because we are also getting nihilistic works such as Taxi Driver, which shares the same cinematographer as this film, we might add, which are the sort of, really bleak looks at what is the current state of America, particularly urban America, in the late 1970s, in a country that has, survived things such as Vietnam, and is dealing grappling with the aftermath of, the various acts of violence and horror throughout the 1960s. Like, it's not.
And that's also a film, though, that is explicitly about the sort of negotiation that has to take place to survive in an urban environment.
Well, precisely. And I think that's the thing about these films. I mean, even is, while certainly not even remotely in the same league as Invasion of the Body Snatchers or Taxi Driver, even Death Wish to a lesser extent, yeah, is dealing with these same feelings of urban alienation and discomfort and, the sort of disintegration, seemingly, of society's social structures.
Though I've got to say, if Charles Bronson was in this film, those aliens did not stand a chance.
No, absolutely. Go ahead, try and copy my mustache.
All right, Dave, you can only do Charles Bronson impressions from now on.
Fair enough. But I mean,
But yeah, like this film isn't it's not completely in its own category, but I think it pulls together some of the social consciousness of contemporaneous American films, but it funnels it through a very interesting, and I don't want to rabbit hole us because I know this could constitute an entire episode itself, but it's impossible to discuss this film without discussing its style.
Yeah.
Because I think maybe why this film seems a bit at odds with its contemporaries is that I feel there's a very, very European influence to it, especially in terms of its cinematography and lighting. Like, it feels odd to describe a color American film from 1978 as expressionistic, but some scenes, like Matthew breaking into the house to rescue Elizabeth, Those initial shots of that play of perspective, when all of a sudden we get to see through Father Robert Duvall's eyes on a swing. You know, the constant layering of white noise through the audio track. And apparently, I haven't gone back to listen, but apparently in those early city scenes, like the alien scream is buried in the mix somewhere.
Okay.
Like, it is a visually striking film. And it's impressionistic or expressionistic in the way that, much like German noir films from the 30s, like there is so much deployment of canted angles in the shooting, of filming characters from above and then panning down to viewing from the rear. You know, Matthew drives around the entire film with a shattered front windshield. Broken by the cooks of the restaurant that he shut down. Like, this is a film that is very, very interested in disrupting normal modes of looking at the everyday.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, the amount of the way in which shadow is used in this film in particular, because I could easily see somebody shooting this film today, and it would be various layers of, you know, different shadow detailing and that, where you can still see all the details. This film is not afraid from, you know, having sections of the screen that go almost pitch black to the point where you can't see anything. And then just having color highlight through in portions of the screen that really stand out. Like, I mean, it is very striking the way in which it's composed in this film, there, particularly the further and further goes on, in particular as we end up into sort of the nighttime sequences. Because, yeah, I mean, the city, the way in which the city is presented is very disorienting and unclear, and our sense of space, again, as the film goes on, is never entirely clear. And there's one sequence I might add that is beautifully edited and composed, and it's the one where before Matthew and Elizabeth meet up with Nancy again, they try and make their way through the streets of San Francisco back to their place of work. And in doing so, you see shots entirely of their feet and legs, composed against, you
Yes.
know, edits of the what are presumably the pod people, and their sort of perfect strides and perfect synchronization of the way in which they walk. And again, just cross-cutting with Elizabeth and Matthew trying and not quite succeeding at doing it. And you wouldn't think just shots of people's legs and that on a street would be that striking, but man, oh man, does Michael Chapman shoot the hell out of it in those sequences? And then watching it being with that sort of increasingly rapid editing between them, it's just magnificently done.
Yeah, because especially the score at that point, it almost gets to Peter and the Wolf
Yeah.
territory, where it's just like the footsteps are tracked to the beats almost. And so you have at one and the same time like this almost clockwork precision and like the gritting out of human behavior and like the measured stride and like the metronomic pulse of it. But then all of a sudden it grows more and more chaotic as they're discovered until it breaks down completely.
Absolutely. And it's probably a good point out at this time that the music is by Denny Zeitlin. Hopefully I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Who, from what I can tell, didn't actually have much of any real film work aside from this movie. From if I'm the information I have is correct, he was predominantly worked as a jazz composer and at the time. So to not have many film credits to your name and to come on and create the kind of oral soundscape for this movie that he does in terms of his music and working with the sound effects as well, it's stunning work, hands without question. Like, just beautiful stuff. And it's not, again, I say that without, you know, this is not a film where you're going to come out humming anything, because it's not that kind of score.
Yeah, exactly. You can't get a vinyl copy of Love Theme from Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yes.
But yeah, like, I mean, last week with Star Trek, we were talking once again about Jerry Goldsmith and how, sort of, through the films we've encountered, there is that interesting fusion of sort of the dissonant and synthetic with the organic and the classical. And I feel like there's a similar integration happens here, but like especially in terms of how the audio is mixed and the sound design in general, like it feels like a meticulously crafted score. And I think it basically takes everything that Goldsmith does at the best of times and just happens to make it a little bit better.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely, it's going for a much more singular affect, I think, than what Goldsmith has done in the films we've covered so far. Because certainly I think things such as Logan's Run and Star Trek are more conventional in the terms of how much room they have to play in terms of emotional context, emotional beats, and just the kind of movies they are. Whereas this film, I mean, again, if nothing else, I mean, this is very much the idea of Edgar Allan Poe's, everything building towards a singular affect as the basis for a good short story. I think this film is pretty much the filmic equivalent of that in some way, where everything really is centered around ultimately getting to that final moment of Donald Sutherland pointing at you and screaming like a lunatic.
See, it's funny you mentioned that because, as I recall, it was also your idea to watch Premature Burial. But yeah, I mean, it feels like a pretty monolithic film in that, and as we were talking about before we started recording, like, it's not that this is a superficial film. It's not that, it's light and fluffy. It's pretty singular in its focus, and it gives it a thematic and stylistic unity throughout it. The only problem is that it is just so harrowing to go through that, like, it's a very interesting fact that by the end, we feel like Matthew and Elizabeth, and we're just too damn tired to run anymore. And, like, that it's a cool sensation, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't know how often I can rewatch this film and go through it. Like, by the time you get to the end, you feel like this film has taken a toll on you.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this is, I mean, it's a, I mean, it's a an affecting movie. I'm not necessarily sure whether I'd call it a fun movie, but I mean, as a straight up horror film, it works like gangbusters. But because of that, you're right. I'm not sure that this is something that I would pull off the shelf and just watch at any given time. You have to be in a certain mind frame to throw this movie on and be willing to go through it. And I mean, certainly, it's not a film for, I would say this is very much an adult horror movie in many ways as well. Like, and I mean that not in the sense that there's tons of adult content in it as far as, blood and gore and nudity and sex. It's just that you have to have a certain level of emotional maturity and fortitude to be able to get through this movie.
Well, yeah, and this is sort of when coming from that period where horror and sci-fi go from being B movies to sort of being integrated into that more, not saying that it reaches the level of high art, but I think there's definitely more of an art house influence, and sort of in doing so, kind of trying to repurpose that and be like, okay, well, I mean, compare this to a film like Don't Look Now. And you can see that they're sort of doing a similar project where it's like, we're going to take what 20 years ago would have been gimmicky drive-in fuel, and we are also going to have some incredibly talented people put it together. What's the outcome?
Well, and I think this is the interesting thing about Coffin, because I think the thing that really comes through in this film is he's not approaching science fiction from a place of disrespect in his thing. Like, there are filmmakers who, okay, sci-fi movie, whatever, I'll just do whatever the hell it takes. I think, Kaufman and Ridley Scott and Steven Spielberg at this point in time, they were trying to make good on the promise of what sci-fi could be. And that's not a knock on the films that preceded it, because there are tons of great science fiction films made through long before the 1970s ever happened. I mean, there's a reason the 1950s is held as the golden age of sci-fi. But it's also the recognition that, when they made those films in the 1950s, they were often working with, limited resources, or were basically viewed as the gutter genre, and often not, in the case of science fiction film, sometimes were made or frequently made with a lack of awareness of contemporary science of the time, let alone science as it would develop over the next 20, 30 years, necessarily. Hence why we get things such as Your Hands Have Been Magnetized from that wonderful classic, This Island Earth.
Hey Dave, let's pretend that anybody actually gets that reference.
There are plenty of people who will get that reference.
Well, hopefully some of them listen to us.
Keep watching, Mystery Science Theater 3000 fans. But yeah, before I completely derailed us there with that, was there anything re really that we haven't covered necessarily, Andrew, that you think we need to dive into with this one?
Well, I think if there is anything we haven't covered, Then we should talk about in our patent pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where we celebrate the little things that make us grin and make us groan and make us open our mouths and point and make that horrible sound. So, Dave, I got to pick the film this week. So, I'm wondering, what is one of your hits for Invasion of the Body Snatchers in 1978?
Man Dog. Anybody who's seen the film knows exactly what I'm talking about, but if for a film.
I had seen the film and I did not remember Man Dog.
It is one of those images where, okay, and one of the things that this film does that is definitely not in the original short story and in the original film version. At one point, the homeless man and his dog are come by Matthew, and if I remember correctly, doesn't he smash like the pod for one of them or something like
Yes.
that? So you would think it would end there. So cut to a few scenes later, and Matthew and Elizabeth are, having just talked to Nancy, realize they have to show no emotion and make their way through the crowd, and they can just blend in and be okay. And then this dog walks up with the head of a man, the homeless man from earlier. And it's very clear, the implication being that, yeah, when the one pod was destroyed, the other one that was feeding, taking over the dog, decided just to absorb the other owner as well. And honestly, it is a creepy image when you see it, without
Well,
question.
yeah. I mean, my immediate flashback was to our episode on the Split, where we came up with the idea of 101 Borgnines. And now I'm like, I don't want to see that movie anymore.
And I can understand why, because it is, again, because it is the effect, it goes by very quickly. They do not linger on the shot of it there. Probably for good reason, because I imagine if you went any longer than it did, the effect would probably wear off. But man, oh man, when it comes in, it is such a jarring moment. And probably one of the only things I would say qualifies as a jump scare in this movie.
Yeah, and like one of the moments where it tips probably most overtly into horror territory
Yeah.
as opposed to sci-fi.
Absolutely. And it works. Like, it's one of those moments where you don't need to go any further than that. That just tells you everything you need to know about this situation. So, but yeah, that would be my first hit. And what about you, Andrew? Is there a, what would be your first one be?
Well, I guess on the heels of that, I would like to point out I'm going to give my first hit to the special effects work in this film. It was overseen by Russell Hesse and Del Rome. I hope I'm getting that right, pulling a David. This is a film where it's not as grandiose and not as sort of body horror as certainly John Carpenter's The Thing or David Cronenberg's work through the 1980s, but I feel like it's an interesting precursor to some of that, especially some of the effects like the pods themselves. I think the effects work is really interesting. There's just disturbing organicism. That opening sequence where the raindrops land on the leaves and just stay there, I think is a pretty wonderful effect. And certainly when Donald Sutherland ends up picking up garden tools and then deciding to pulp the head of a mostly foreign pod person, like, it's 1978. It's practical effects. It is brutal and disgusting. And yeah, like, this is not a film that relies on its special effects, but every time they're deployed, they're integrated incredibly well. It's very unsettling. And again, like, they hit that balance of approximating the human body while being just uncanny enough. It consistently works throughout the film, and I can't think of like any effects shots where it doesn't work. I think if it held on the face of Man Dog, you can sort of see the seams begin to show there. But this is also a film that's smart enough about knowing when to cut away and knowing how to give you just enough. So part of that comes down to Philip Kaufman and his sensibilities as a director, but he wouldn't have that raw material to work with without his effects department. So kudos to you, gentlemen.
No, absolutely. So another individual I would want to give a shout out here is somebody who we haven't mentioned by name, and that's screenwriter W.D. Richter, who probably is most famous for going on to direct a little film called The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. But he also wrote, or at least co-wrote, Big Trouble in Little China for John Carpenter a few years later. And his script is very smart and sly, and actually is filled with a lot of really great dialogue. And not in the sense of it's stuff you can go around quoting, but everything feels authentic and natural in a way that not every film is able to have. Like, you can almost see all things as being somewhat improvised in moments, and that's not an easy quality to get across when you're writing something, because I imagine this film had to be very heavily scripted in order to pull off half of what they do here. So, I mean, there are just tons of great dialogue to get. I mean, again, some of these speeches that Nancy or Veronica Cartwright gets is Nancy, even though she is kind of an underdeveloped character, are delightful. Likewise, you know, Goldblum's, you know, endless patter of dialogue at any given moment is fabulous. And even Nimoy.
Yeah, the party scene in particular, and the exchange she has with the woman, who apparently is played by Philip Kaufman's wife at the time, their banter I really enjoy a lot, where she eventually stumps him, and then his response is, "Well, I wasn't even talking to you in the first place," and just storms off.
Absolutely. And I, again, just even like little details such as Kibner's leaving, just, you know, grabbing Jack by there and saying, "Oh, by the way, I think there's a woman up there who's really interested in your work and wants to see you." Like, just there's that kind of gentle screw you that he's clearly throwing in Jack's face, because as some, yeah,
there's a good sense of camaraderie amongst the gang.
Yeah,
even when they don't like each other, they all play pretty well in terms of character dynamics with each other, and there is that sense of looseness. And I think it encapsulates the idea of a bunch of people terrified beyond their wits in 1978 San Francisco. Like, it feels like a natural fit.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. So, but yeah, so that definitely deserves credit there. And again, I think structurally the film is really tightly done by Richter as well. So kudos to him. But Andrew, what would be your final hit for this one?
A part of me wants to dedicate it to Leonard Nimoy's Single Glove. But I think I'm going to give it to Donald Sutherland, because, I mean, we don't get a whole lot of backstory for Matthew. Like, really, what we see on screen is all we get to form an opinion of him. Like, we're not given any allusions to his life before this. But in the process of this film, we spend 2 hours watching a man go from being very self-assured, sort of a wise-ass, you know, a bit of a playboy, maybe. We see him then move into having to take control of a situation or try and assert some responsibility. We have to see him respond to crisis, and then we see him resign to the fact that absolutely nothing he does is going to get them out of this situation. And, like, at all times, Sutherland feels believable. He seems very vulnerable. And right up until the moment that he completely loses his humanity, he feels like a very human figure in this landscape. And I think you need a performance like that for the action on screen to be plausible. And I mean, that's not to say that the rest of the cast doesn't do their part, but I mean, Sutherland in particular, yeah, like, he basically goes through the biggest range of emotions as a character, and I think in every scene that he has to do something, he hits it out of the park. It's not as, probably, as weighty a role as something like Don't Look Now. It may not even be as instantly memorable as something like Animal House, and it's probably not as cool as he was in The Split, but I think, yeah, it's an odd character. He's given odd things to do, and he somehow finds a way to make it all work.
Well, even just a scene like the fact when Elizabeth, for lack of a better term, dies in his arms as he's cradling her body, and it just disintegrates. When you cut to his face, and just, again, the look on it and the sort of quiet terror he's experiencing at that moment, and utter horror, you know, there's a way that that moment could have been overplayed, and Sutherland does not do it.
Yeah, he doesn't look up to the sky and scream, "No!"
Exactly. It is just like a man who has no ability to fully comprehend what's going on right in front of him. So, no, I completely agree with that.
Yeah, and if you slow it down frame by frame, you can pinpoint the exact second when his heart breaks in half. Oh, wait. I'm thinking of Ralph Wiggum.
Kudos there. This episode make win for most number of off-tangent references. Which is saying something for our show.
Until next week, anyway. Yeah. Yeah, they said make your show more accessible. So it's like, well, if we reference everything, then sooner or later people will tune in. Worked for Family Guy.
That was exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, God.
Damn.
Oh, no wonder we do a podcast together. And much like our humor, though, certain elements of the film don't always go to plan, or they seem better in your head than they do on the screen. And that would be the pits.
Yes.
David, in a film as sprawling and messy as this one, I'm sure there's bound to be at least one or two. What is one of your pits for this week?
It's a good question, and the funny thing is, it's not so much the pits. I have more questions in the back of my mind that I think are deliberate in the case of the film, and I think very productive questions it's left with. So I don't want to say that that's a pit, because it's not the case. If I actually had to select something that constitutes a pit, as awesome as it is, Robert Duvall's pop-up at the start there is kind of a little distracting. I mean, if it had been anybody else other than Duvall in that scene, just a random extra, it would probably have worked just as well. But the fact that we recognize that it's Duvall, it's like, oh, what's he doing here? What's going on? Because he was working by the 70s. I would have to imagine some people recognized him. So I don't want to say it takes you out of the film, but it's the closest the film comes to that happening.
Well, that being said, this was my third time watching it. This was the first time I noticed Robert Duvall.
Okay, so there we go. It may not...
To be fair, I'm also an idiot.
I wouldn't agree with that, but, I mean, certainly, yes. So, depending upon how aware you are of Robert Duvall and his receding hairline, you may or may not recognize him at the start. Although, we kind of spoiled where he is, so I guess you will.
Yeah.
Where's
Duvaldo? never again. I think it kind of is a... It gets a pass for me only because, if anything, that just further speaks to the fact that this is not the film you assume it's going to be. Because any other film like that, it's like, oh, hey, I didn't know Robert Duvall was in this. And then he has some kind of impact, right?
Yeah.
It's Chekhov's cameo appearance. And that does not happen here. He's just there, and we assume his perspective. And then he's gone, and this all happens for literally no reason.
Yes.
So I think it works with this film's project of destabilizing.
It's certainly not it's a super minor nitpick, but I think that just is sort of telling to the quality of this movie, when that's the sort of my starting point, is a super minor nitpick about it. So take that as a positive, if you will, folks. What about Andrew? You, what do you have that might be considered a pit here?
I think, honestly, the only other one I have, maybe a super minor one as well. Generally, when I watch films, I try and get it all done in one block. Because that's how, you know, movies are... That's how they're generally intended to be received. Plus, I have a terrible attention span sometimes. I had to answer the phone, though, at one point, and... Then when I sat down to restart the movie from where I had left off, I thought that I was pretty close to the end, because this was shortly after the foot scene, where all of a sudden they're discovered by the crowd. And then I realized that that's only about an hour and 10 minutes into this 2-hour movie, and I had this feeling of just kind of like, ugh. Like, It's not that it's a slow or dull film as much as it's just a harrowing film, and it can leave you feeling pretty exhausted. Like, this isn't quite as spectacular when it ramps up as something like The Thing by John Carpenter. Like, it's a remarkably unified piece, even if it's not always the most clear in what it's aiming to do. But at the same time, like, it does wear away at you. And I think that's just, you know, don't slide this in like a late night creature feature double bill with like Robot Monster and Plan 9 from Outer Space. This is not that kind of movie. I think owing to its sort of art house influences, it's definitely designed for a more attentive audience. So, I mean, yeah, like there's a lot of moving parts. And I think to be that intended audience, you have to sort of be aware of all of them. It adds up to a lot when everything that's happening is on the note of, oh, by the way, this isn't going to end well. I think maybe, I guess, stemming from that, there's a couple scenes that I feel are almost redundant. I feel like the idea of them trying to blend in with the crowd and immediately getting discovered, that happens at least twice. And I'm like, well, surely we get the idea after the first one. I mean, because you have Man Dog, and then you have the foot scene, and it's like, well, they basically achieve the same effect and lead to the same outcome of Elizabeth and Matthew being chased by a crowd through the streets. So it's like, it's really neat. I'm not going to say that I know how to make a better version of this film. It just seems odd. So yeah, if you're expecting a thrill ride, this isn't that. That's not really a criticism, though.
No, I mean, it's the nature of the beast we're dealing with. I mean, either you're on its wavelength or you're not. And if you're absolutely not enjoying the film while you're watching it, you know what? I don't think that there's anything late in the game that's really going to change it for people. I mean, you have to be willing to go with it.
Well, you just wait another 15 years and then watch Abel Ferrara's version.
One day, I really am curious to come back and do an episode on that one because that's a whole nother kettle of fish. And certainly it will not be involve nearly as much praise as we've given this film. But
Well, I guess it's up to you to link us to Bad Lieutenant first.
I will find a way.
Well, but speaking of linking up, though, I guess that about brings us to the end of this interesting, depressing urban journey. So, Dave, I'm gonna sit in the back seat and try very hard not to fall asleep. And why don't you tell us where we're going next episode?
Well, number one, beware the thermos of coffee in the back there. But number two, next week, what we're going to be doing is we're going to follow Charles Rosen, the production designer on Invasion of the Body Snatchers, to one of the to a very nuanced, sophisticated film from 1983 known as Flashdance, starring Jennifer Beals and directed by Adrian Lyne. And, with a screenplay co-written by Joe Esterhaus. So, it's going to be full of, authenticity in terms of its subject matter.
I would just like to point out that half an hour ago you pointed out that this film could have linked to Taxi Driver, and I'm just going to let that lie.
I'm also going to point out for the record, folks, I gave Andrew three options for possibly the following next week. At no point in time was Taxi Driver any one of those three.
Yeah, you listed Space Jam as Taxi Driver.
I
And
regret
this,
nothing.
folks, is how the show gets made.
So, but yes, I will say this. A, I think it'll be less weighty than the film we've just discussed. And also, we haven't covered a musical since really, the very first episode of the show. So, you know what? I mean, it's not quite a musical per se, but it's close enough for our purposes. So,
Well, who says you can't go home again?
exactly. So tune in next week for that. But until then, let's just say that somebody wanted to yell at us for not doing Taxi Driver. That isn't Andrew. Where can they scream at me, Andrew?
Well, they could scream at you at 24 panels on Twitter. And where could they scream at me,
Well, if
David?
they want to scream at you, they can do that by contacting you on Twitter at FilmStripper. Just make sure you remember which one of us did not choose Taxi Driver for next week's episode.
And if you want to scream at both of us at the same time, feel free to hop on over to our page on iTunes or whatever podcatching service you use. Feel free to rate and review. 5-star reviews help us get more eyes and ears on the product, but your feedback is what helps us make this show into the show that you want to listen to. We can't get better if you don't tell us what's broke, and we can't keep doing the stuff you love if you don't tell us you love it. So, trust us, believe it or not, we're pretty okay at being self-deprecating, and that doesn't just crumble away when other people deprecate us as well.
Exactly. So, until next time, Andrew, are there any parting words you would like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
I'm just going to point out for the record how disappointed I am that you didn't just start screeching at the top of your lungs.
Well, I didn't want to put the audio in the red. I guess that's proof that we're still humans. We're deeply flawed.
Bye, folks.